From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Leaders across the Asia-Pacific are convening in Bali this week to talk economic progress. APEC will go on without President Obama, who is home dealing with the ongoing government shutdown. Secretary of State John Kerry is there working to reassure the region.
There is nothing that will shake the commitment of the United States to the rebalance to Asia that President Obama is leading.
But China is eager to fill the void. This hour on Point, U.S.-Asia relations and the world stage without President Obama. You can join us on air or online. Are you worried the U.S. looks vulnerable on the world stage this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Bali is Indira Lakshmanan, senior correspondent for Bloomberg News, covering foreign policy. She's all over APEC this week. Indira, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
So the president is not there at APEC. What's the reaction to his absence?
Right. Well, certainly there's not been a thrilling reaction from Asia. You have a lot of Asian leaders who have privately said that they think it shows a diminished U.S. And in fact, the Jakarta Globe, one of the leading English language newspapers here in Indonesia, had literally a photo of Obama looking stressed about the government shutdown with the massive headline saying diminished superpower. And it's just one example of the reaction that we've seen throughout. RT, Russia Today, has headlines like, you know, shutdown allows China's Xi to upstage Obama's pivot. Meanwhile, China Daily out here has a headline saying pivot to Asia sidelined by U.S. domestic woes. So there's no question that the view is that China and Russia are making hay of the absence of the U.S. leader here.
We'll get to that. Let me play some sounds first yesterday of Secretary of State John Kerry saying that despite the president's absence and America's government shutdown, other nations should not see the domestic policy dispute as a sign of weakness. Here he is.
To all of our friends and foes watching around the world, let me be crystal clear. Do not mistake this momentary episode in American politics as anything less than a moment of politics, or anything more than a moment of politics.
Also, at the APEC summit yesterday, Singapore's prime minister told CNN that President Obama's absence from APEC has an impact on Asia and the rest of the world.
The dollar amount is not consequential, but the signal that the Americans are unable to get their act together and can't vote money to run the government and can't agree that the government needs to be run and has national interests greater than the Tea Party or the Democrats or the Republicans, I think that's a negative signal.
Singapore's president there doesn't mince words, Indira. You answered it, sounds like. Asian leaders are beginning to question the U.S. commitment and stability, at least to their corner of the world.
I think there is disappointment, and it's palpable. And it's striking that it was Singapore's leader who made those comments, because of any country in Southeast Asia, Singapore is one of the United States' closest friends. So to have them publicly and other leaders privately making cutting comments about ability to be here, it's not encouraging. Now, part of this, of course, is on one level a cry for help, if you can call it that, in that there are a lot of Southeast Asian nations who are looking to the United States for leadership in Asia, and they were embracing the so-called Obama Asia pivot that was announced a couple of years ago, because they were looking for the United States to be a counterbalance to the rise of China, both economically and militarily. And part of what the Obama administration has done to try to achieve that is embracing this very ambitious trade pact called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, trying to get the U.S. and 11 of its partners in this region together with new trade rules. And the absence of the president from being here to chair talks towards that end obviously gives China an opportunity to work on its own rival trade bloc that it's working on. So, you know, there are many levels in which this is difficult for the United States. There's that economic level. Strategically as well, it means the president is not here to sort of make the case about navigation and rules of the road over maritime disputes, where China has annoyed a lot of its neighbors with its claims over disputed territory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another way in which some of the U.S. allies in this region really wish that Obama had been here. And even though Kerry certainly came and made all the points that, you know, with the tape that you had of Kerry speaking, it's not the same to not have a president here, and everyone admits that.
So talk more about that Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal that's being negotiated at the summit. Why is it important to the U.S., and why would these new trade rules be significant?
Right. This is something that was started by the Obama administration 3 years ago, and there have been literally dozens of rounds of negotiations and ministerials to try to get a deal done. And the way that the Obama administration describes it is sort of a new architecture for trade with ambitious rules of the road to try to update trading rules and a framework with new things that exist. So it would take into account new technologies, it would take into account intellectual property, it would try to bring down barriers in all sorts of ways, address problems with agricultural tariffs and state-owned enterprises. And in a way, it's been told to us by U.S. officials, that I actually did an interview with the U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman for Bloomberg Television, and he essentially said to us that this is a self-selecting group of countries who came forward themselves wanting to be part of this ambitious trade deal. The problem is the president has put forward a goal of trying to complete these negotiations by the end of this year.
Right.
And everyone admits that that is a very ambitious goal because there's still a lot of niggling points, different countries who, you know, still have issues with state-owned enterprises or preferential treatment for certain groups in their country. And, you know, it's not clear, even though they came out with a communique today, that they still are maintaining progress and hoping to get a goal of an agreement by the end of the year without President Obama here to chair that meeting. There's no doubt that some momentum would have been lost towards that goal.
You mentioned China. Some have framed the president's absence from APEC as some kind of success for China, who is anxious to fill the void at these meetings. Would you agree with that? Is that accurate?
Look, it's interesting the way that China and Russia, the two, you know, major powers who are here while the United States is not, how their leaders have each addressed Obama's absence. Now, Chinese President Xi Jinping didn't even mention the United States in his speech that he gave to the conference yesterday. It was very narrowly focused on China, what China can do for the region, how China has so much to contribute, how the rest of Asia can't grow without China, and China can't grow without the rest of Asia. So it was basically a campaign slogan, you could say, for why Asia and China need to rise together. Russian President Putin, interestingly, made very sympathetic noises both yesterday and today in his public comments about the shutdown, and essentially said, poor Obama, I understand where he's coming from, and I would have done exactly the same thing in his shoes, and we understand this is domestic politics, and, you know, essentially made sympathetic noises. The only thing is, you wonder on some level, you know, maybe it's genuine, but it's also somewhat condescending, and, you know, it certainly also gives Putin the chance to step front and center, because his remarks and Xi's remarks from China became the two most important speeches of this conference.
But Indira, you know, this isn't the first time that a president has missed the APEC summit. I mean, you think about President Clinton, who canceled his trip, in 1995. That was the last time that there was a government shutdown in the U.S. But there is greater competition right now for the influence of the U.S. and or China, more dynamic economies in Asia generally. Is that the difference now, would you say?
Well, the president missed last year's APEC summit, remember, because of the election. It was so close to the election. And I was actually at that summit with Hillary Clinton, who stood in for him in Vladivostok, Russia. But it wasn't considered so much of a big deal for him to be absent at that time, because people understood it was because of the, you know, the presidential election. But, you know, in the category of a picture telling a thousand words, it was very striking to look at the family photo, as they call them, them, which is the annual photo that they take at these APEC summits with all of the leaders wearing native garb. So it's this striking photo across a red carpet stage with all of the leaders of the more than 20 APEC countries wearing beautiful Indonesian batik shirts. And on either side of the Indonesian president, Indonesia is, of course, the host, you see China's Xi Jinping on one side, you see Russia's Vladimir Putin on the other side, and way off in the back of the second row on the far right, almost off stage, is John Kerry. So your listeners might have seen that the Washington Post actually posted this picture with a little caption saying, "The most powerful and richest country in the world, look at the upper right-hand corner." So
how is President Obama's...
It's not good.
How is President Obama's so-called pivot strategy affected now moving forward after his absence at APEC and sort of everything that's happened so far?
Look, this is not the first thing that is threatening to derail his Asia pivot. This is, been the signature policy of the Obama administration for its second term in terms of its foreign policy. Let's not forget that Asia is the part of the world responsible for half of the world's GDP. Just the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries in themselves are responsible for $28 trillion in GDP a year. And the majority of the growth outside of the U.S. in the next 5 years is all happening in Asia. So there are a lot of really important economic reasons for Obama to turn his attention to Asia. But like I was saying, this is not the first thing that is setting this off course. We had the crisis in Syria. We had the crisis in Egypt. There have been all sorts of problems, foreign policy crises, most of them in the Middle East, that the president has had to deal with that have taken his attention away from Asia. And it's always that thing, the tension that you have in any foreign policy docket between the issues that are urgent versus the issues that are simply important.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about APEC this hour and the U.S. role in Asia. In November 2011, President Obama met with Thailand's prime minister and in a joint press conference said the United States has strong interests in the Asia-Pacific region.
As the fastest growing region in the world, the Asia-Pacific will shape so much of our security and prosperity in the century ahead, and it is critical to creating jobs and opportunity for the American people. And that's why I've made restoring American engagement in this region a top priority as president.
We're speaking this hour with Indira Lakshmanan, who is in Bali covering the APEC summit for Bloomberg News. And joining me now from New York is Susan Shirk, professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. She is chair of the 21st Century China Program. Susan Shirk, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Jane.
So how do you view this? Has the president's absence taken some gravitas out of the conference, to your mind?
I believe that the impact of President Obama's absence from the APEC leaders' meeting and later the East Asian summit has been exaggerated. I think that there's great damage to our standing in the region that we have brought upon ourselves by our dysfunctional politics and the irresponsible actions of the Republicans, in particular in Congress. And the fact that we can't get our own house in order. But don't you think that people in Asia would be worrying about that regardless of whether or not Obama got on an airplane and made his way to these meetings? And I think every leader of a country understands that it would have been impossible for President Obama to leave the helm at this perilous time.
Do you see the president's absence from APEC as a win for China, for China's effort to exert more influence in the region?
You know, it's so interesting because both in the United States and in China and in other countries too, we have this kind of primitive way of looking at the world as if everything is a big win for somebody and a big loss for somebody. And, of course, international relations is much more complex than that. I think that from China's perspective, it has felt quite in some ways quite isolated in Asia over the past several years because it created its own backlash by its assertive actions over territorial issues in particular and mishandling relations with South Korea. So it has a lot of rebuilding of trust within Asia to do for itself. And from its standpoint, probably one advantage of having President Obama absent is that the heat is no longer on China.
Hmm. Let's get a caller in here. Ron is in Nashville, Tennessee, waiting to join the conversation. Ron, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
Yes, yes, I like listening to your show, and, you know, that's how I stay, you know, up on a lot of the politics. But I agree 100% with the speaker you have on now. You know, the world's going to look at us like if we can't rule our own house, how can we rule out there and everything? And I really feel it's a sad commentary on our government to where they can't settle their differences, whether they're Republican or Democrat, you know, and get this thing right. We elected, you know, the president to be who he is, and we should have things in order to where he can go out and represent us throughout the world and everything.
Ron, thank
and
you.
I feel like
yeah, I'm glad you called, and I hear your point. Susan Shirk, would you respond to that? I mean, the image of the U.S. around the world, is it changing?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is extremely damaging to our image around the world. And let's remember that in countries like China or in countries even like Malaysia or Indonesia where democracy is not so well established, there's a lot of domestic debate over the whether or not democracy is the best way to govern a country. And when people look at divided government in the United States and how we it seems to lead to deadlock, it gives greater credence to the arguments that authoritarian governments are more decisive. Now, it's not actually true. In China, there's a lot of difficulty getting agreement on policies. Consensus building within their political system isn't as easy as it may look from outside. But the fact of the matter is that the political reformers in a country like China are weakened when American democracy fails in the way it appears to have done recently.
Susan Shirk, as Indira mentioned, there's so much talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal at the APEC summit. But there are real questions about how the president could possibly get a trade pact through Congress right now, given the hostility and deadlock, gridlock that's going on toward many of our domestic policy issues. How do you see it? How do you view that particular point?
I think you're absolutely right, Jane. I think this is the problem, not whether or not the meeting is being chaired by President Obama or Secretary Kerry. The problem is that interest groups in Malaysia or Vietnam or Japan or South Korea, these countries that are contemplating making serious concessions in terms of domestic protections for their interest groups in order to join this high-quality trade agreement, do they really want to pay the domestic price and do that and then have the president unable to get it through Congress? So I think, but even before this domestic crisis in the United States, I think there were serious questions about whether or not this deal would be done by the end of the year. So it probably slows things down substantially, but it was going to be a tough thing to achieve in any case.
Here's Pat in Hancock, Michigan. Pat, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jen. I'm really glad there is some talk about the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. I would like to ask if anyone has actually seen any of it. I've heard it's extremely top secret. And Lori, I think her name is Wallach, of the Global Trade Watch, did say when some pages were leaked, that it is four chapters or maybe five chapters regarding trade, and the other 24 chapters are regarding ways that they will, countries that are signatories to this will be able to override sovereign governments, environmental, labor, health, all types of laws, mm-hmm. including local governments not being allowed to restrict any particular types of uses in their areas.
I got your question. Let's take it to Indira. Thanks so much for the call, Pat. Why the secrecy surrounding the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal?
I think it's standard practice that when trade deals are being negotiated, that they are kept, it's not just secret till the end, but there's not an actual deal until there's a deal. And this is one of the things that the U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman said in his interview with us, which is, you know, there is no deal until every part of it is done. And, you know, I posed to him this question about groups such as, you know, the Global Trade Watch that she was referring to. There are various interest groups who have concerns about possible labor or environmental lowering of standards. There are some groups who worry about food safety standards being lowered. You've also got automakers concerned on protectionism issues. So there are a lot of interest groups in the U.S. who are concerned about it. At the same time, you have, you know,
sounds like we lost Indira. Susan Shirk, are you there? And would you answer the question about the strategy behind the U.S. excluding China from the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Jane, because actually the United States has not excluded China. And it, as we heard earlier, it's a self-selected group of countries. And President Xi Jinping, when he came to California earlier this year to have an informal meeting with President Obama at Sunnylands, his team asked for a briefing on Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the Chinese government has never said absolutely that it would not join TPP. And in fact, many economic reformers who were trying to push forward China's domestic economic and financial system reforms are very interested in the idea of China making these international commitments as a way of driving progress on the domestic economy, just as former Premier Zhu Rongji back in the late 90s got China to negotiate its entry to the World Trade Organization as a way of breaking down protectionist barriers and improving the market economy domestically in China. So, you know, I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that someday China will be a member of TPP.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Jakarta, Indonesia. Andy Bayuni, senior editor at the Jakarta Post. Andy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm well. Tell me how you're covering the APEC summit in the Indonesian news this week.
Well, it's a big story for us when, you know, so many global leaders are in the country. So we are deploying a big team to cover the event, the summit, and also, of course, the preceding meetings of the ministers that started since a week ago.
And what is the response there to President Obama's absence at the APEC summit?
Well, I think it's unfortunate, but, because it would have been nice to have Obama back in Indonesia. This is a country where he spent about 4 years of his childhood. He had been to Indonesia, I think, twice in the past. This would be his third time as president. He would have been given a warm welcome if he had come, but, of course, he couldn't make it. For reasons that are quite understandable. It is very unfortunate, but, you know, the show must go on, and the summit went on without Obama.
Is Indonesia feeling the weight of China more than the weight of the United States these days?
Well, yeah. Well, it's a little bit of both. There is a kind of rivalry between the United States and China, and I think every country in Asia are feeling this rivalry, and every country in Asia is trying to position themselves in the best way that serves their national interests. Indonesia, as the host, of course, is put is coming under a lot of pressure from both China and United States. But you know, without Obama in town, as I think the President Xi Jinping is virtually stealing the show. He came to Jakarta as an official visit to, last week. You know, his first visit to a Southeast Asian country since he was elected, and then he's coming back to Bali for the APEC summit.
So how do you see, or how do Indonesians see, President Obama's so-called pivot strategy that he talked so much about a couple of years ago? You know, it was not only about economics, it was also about allocating U.S. military resources in so many other ways to sort of put the U.S. right in the middle of the Asia century, as he called it. What has been the impact to your mind?
Well, there were concerns expressed by Indonesia and by a few other countries in the region that the pivot to Asia was perceived as a measure to counter the rise of China. And I think that that is not helping the situation. It just antagonized China even further and put many countries who are trying to be in the middle in a very awkward position. Indonesia certainly is a big country. We did not want to be seen as allying with one or the other powers. But the smaller countries, I think they have no choice, the Philippines, Vietnam, Singapore, and of course the traditional allies like Korea and Japan, they immediately ally themselves with the United States. But you know, the last thing you want is a bipolar Asia where countries have to make a choice between United States or China. So I think the pivot was not very helpful. And I think it is good that in some way it is good that the pivot is not working, or it's not, at least it's not happening so far. And maybe, you know, the events of the past few weeks, you know, Syria, Iran, this raised questions about Obama's foreign policy doctrine. And maybe he should also review his Asian policy.
We continue to hear that elements of the manufacturing sector are moving from Asia back to the United States. I'm curious if you see that in Asia, if you feel that, and if so, how that's impacting President Obama's pivot strategy.
I'm not sure whether manufacturing are moving back to the United States because, it's a very dynamic situation. In fact, Indonesia has been the beneficiary of many American companies who are also investing in Asia other than China, because you know there's many people have focused too much on China and they realize that there are also opportunities in other parts of Asia, and Indonesia has been seen as one. So maybe China is losing some of the investment and manufacturing back to the United States, but I think the rest of Asia is still growing. I think the Philippines is also benefiting, and it's growing by 6 or 7%. Indonesia is still growing by 6%.
Do you think the APEC meeting would turn out differently if President Obama was there instead of Secretary Kerry? Can Secretary Kerry push forward negotiations on the trade deals the way President Obama would have?
Well, definitely. I think if Obama was here, he would have pushed more on the Trans-Pacific Partnership idea, and he probably would have got more support or more commitment from some of the members or prospective members. I'm sure he could have done much better than John Kerry, but you know the APEC summit is never seen. I have followed the APEC summits in the past. It's not really about the substance of trade and investment liberalization. It's more about the appearance of the leaders, you know, the photo ops, and the meetings on the sidelines. And I think Obama is missing out. He missed out on Vladivostok last year. He's missing it out again this year for the opportunity to, you know, to discuss issues that other than trade and investment that are crucial to the global affairs.
Indy Dubayu, senior editor at the Jakarta Post, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Jane.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at the APEC summit underway in Bali right now and America's long-term economic and strategic pivot to Asia. I'm speaking this hour with Indira Lakshmanan. She covers foreign policy for Bloomberg News, and Susan Shirk, chair of University of California, San Diego's 21st Century China program. Here's some sound from 2011. President Obama began pivoting, quote unquote, toward Asia with both a military buildup in the Pacific as well as a strengthening of economic ties in the region. He addressed the Australian Parliament and said that America would remain a powerful military influence in the Asia Pacific.
Here's what this region must know. As we end today's wars, I have directed my national security team to make our presence and mission in the Asia Pacific a top priority.
Has he done that, Indira Lakshmanan?
So he's tried, but I want to make a point that I think is worth making. It's not just about the government shutdown, and it's not just about Obama's inability to come to APEC. I mean, in a way, that's the latest straw in a whole list of other things that have made it difficult for him to focus on the Asia pivot in the way that he's wanted to. And I want to highlight that a colleague of mine in Washington wrote a really interesting story a week ago today when they, you know, first announced that Obama was not going to be able to go to Malaysia and the Philippines, even before he pulled out of the APEC and the ASEAN summits. And she made the point that, you know, this is the latest in the long string of things that have made our allies and our partners and even our foes around the world question our reliability as a partner. Remember, this is the president who campaigned in 2008 as someone who was going to do nation building at home, who was going to end two wars. So he has always had a largely domestic focus, at least in his public outreach, and he's wanted to focus on the economy and focus on jobs. You know, that's not how the world works, though. The world gets in the way, and all sorts of crises happen, and you have to deal with them and put them out one fire at a time. So what's interesting about the Asia pivot, it was an attempt to get ahead of these problems and not just be reactively, you know, dealing with issues in the Middle East or whatever, but actually trying to proactively look at strategically, economically, with a long-term 20-year or longer view, what can we do to grow the U.S. presence and engagement with the fastest-growing region in the world. That's what this Asia pivot was about. But it wasn't just the shutdown. It was also the crisis over the gas attack in Syria and what was perceived as Obama's waffling by the rest of the world over, was he going to strike? Was he not going to strike? Was he going to go to Congress? Was he even going to be able to get the votes for a strike from Congress? You know, there have been a whole series of examples of other things like this that have made the world question the United States and Obama's commitment to various foreign policy initiatives. There was the Afghan surge where he added more troops and he started taking them away. So there's no question that a lot of American partners and foes have been wondering all along for several years about his commitment to certain foreign policy initiatives, and this is just the latest example of that.
Susan Shirk, describe how you view the president's military pivot. What actually changed militarily, if anything?
Well, the kind of the dirty little secret about the pivot is that militarily it doesn't amount to much. It was always a kind of modest effort to provide the ability for our forces in Asia, which now I think are about 60 to 70,000, based largely in Japan and South Korea, to give them some space to exercise in Australia. That initiative actually began back in the Clinton administration when I served in the government, and I remember we started to discuss it with the Australians all the way back then. Also, other port facilities for our ships, kind of minor tweaking to give our forces in the region a better base for operations if need be. So the budget problems that the United States has is not likely to lead to any reduction in the plans for the military pivot to the region. And in fact, we haven't yet mentioned this quite robust discussion that Secretary Hagel, Secretary of Defense Hagel, and Secretary of State Kerry had with their counterparts in Japan last week about how to strengthen the alliance with Japan, including sending drones out there for the first time, and some other steps that will help the Japanese step up and share more of the responsibility for maintaining peace and stability in the region.
Let's get another listener in here. Ivan is in Gresham, Wisconsin. Ivan, welcome to the program. Glad you waited. Thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling because there is information out there available about this Trans-Pacific partnership.
Yes.
And it's rather extensive, and I know you're not going to be able to take the time. But just for a few things, there are a number of things that will limit it. This is really an international corporate takeover of basically all of these countries and many of their most important sovereign rights, food safety, fracking, employment, drug prices, banks and financial institutions. Would all be subject, well, our internet freedom, public services would all be severely affected in, and I feel, a very negative way by this agreement. I just want to say that the source of a lot of this information, in the event that anybody wants to know, and I hope it's okay, it's the Jim Hightower, the Hightower Lowdown. He has a rather extensive report in there, and I suspect I would highly recommend that anybody who is interested in finding out about as much as you can know today about that agreement that potential agreement would get a hold of a copy of the...
Ivan, thank you. I'm glad you called. I'm going to turn your comments to Indira Lakshman on what about this TTP agreement and Ivan's comments that this is a wide-reaching agreement that the U.S. should be wary of?
Well, I mean, it has not, as we were saying earlier, the more than 24 chapters of this have not been released. They've been tightly held, and what the U.S. Trade Representative's Office and all the other governments say is that there's no deal until there is a final deal, and that the reason that we're hearing more and more concerns from the different governments, including Malaysia and Japan, for example, is that we're getting into what Mike Froman calls the final stretch, and that it's natural that countries would have their concerns. As far as the concerns from domestic interest groups in the U.S., I was talking about that before, that there are people who are concerned about food safety, environmental standards, labor rights, et cetera. I mean, these are not new and unique comments that just relate to TPP. I'd like to point out that some of these same exact comments and complaints were made about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, the South Korea Free Trade Agreement. So, you know, a lot of these arguments are repeated when it comes to any free trade deal. There are a lot of the same concerns. And there's no question that the administration has been criticized by these groups. And what the administration is going to have to do is be as transparent as possible, both with Congress and with interest groups on all sides, and bring them into the process. And the U.S. Trade Representative told me that they are trying to bring people into the process and that there's no rush to finalize a deal before the end of the year without having input from Congress and interest groups. I also want to make one point about something that Indy Bayuni from the Jakarta Post was talking about, which was this notion of, you know, maybe Obama could have gotten more done on the TPP than Kerry standing in for him. And I just want to, you know, sort of set expectations accurately here, which is that there was never going to be a deal coming out of TPP from this week's, summit here at APEC. That was never the goal. That was never going to happen in any case. So all that was happening was this was an opportunity for the leaders to get together and talk about their latest concerns, but the most ambitious timetable was having them come to some sort of an agreement by the end of this year. And to that same point about how there was never going to be a deal coming out of this, I mean, all of these summits, whether it's APEC or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, where we're all going with Kerry tomorrow to Brunei, All of these summits are places where leaders have an opportunity to interact and to talk to each other. But the real people who are making the decisions and these communiques that are getting signed are people like Susan Shirk when she was in the Clinton administration. It's the policymakers, in the back room who are making all of these negotiations and decisions ahead of time, and the leaders come in and sign off on deals that their policymakers have already made. And so what Obama really missed out on was the opportunity to have bilateral meetings with Xi Jinping of China, Vladimir Putin of Russia, and all the rest of the Asia-Pacific leaders. To me, that's what he really missed out on.
Here's Steve in Dothan, Alabama. Hi, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. My point was just, yes, this is just another series of events that makes everything look weak. And I actually do take exception to the one of your previous persons up there blaming the Republicans for all this shutdown. The president shut down the government when he doesn't want to sit there and negotiate with his leadership. I'm sorry if you don't like it. I'm sorry if he doesn't want. But you can't sit there and stand up and say, I'm not doing anything until you see it my way. It don't work that way.
Steve,
that's the problem.
Steve, thanks. Here's David from Woodbury, Connecticut with another view. David, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hello. I believe the Republicans really have made themselves look like perfect fools, and it's really on the Republicans. John Kerry, I believe, will do just fine over there, and I'm sure the president and John Kerry will be in very close touch during this. But it's just a darn shame. The Republicans, led by Ted Cruz, I think that's about it.
All right, David, thank you very much. One call per perspective. Here's Peter in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. I noticed that no one's talked about the territorial conflicts in the China Sea, and I was wondering if your guests might talk about the possibility that they would involve us in some sort of conflict between China and either Japan or the Philippines.
Interesting point, Peter. Thank you. Susan Shirk, would you respond?
Well, U.S. policy is that we have a national interest in freedom of navigation in South China Sea and in those territorial disputes being resolved peacefully. We don't take a stand on the territorial issues per se, and we don't have a treaty commitment to defend the claims of any of the countries at all. So it's quite different from the territorial dispute in the East China Sea that China has with Japan, because there, I think there is a greater risk that the U.S. could be forced to be involved because it's complicated, but Japan has had administration of those rocks in the East China Sea. And according to our treaty obligations, we are committed to help Japan defend itself and areas over which it has administration. So that's the situation. I think regardless of whether or not we have a formal commitment in the South China Sea, we do have a lot at stake in encouraging all the parties, China and everyone else, to exercise restraint and to get going in negotiating this code of conduct that they have been talking about since the 1990s. Mm-hmm.
Steve, thanks so much for the call.
May I jump in for a moment?
Go ahead, Indira. Yes, please.
For a moment, Jane. Yeah, I just wanted to say we did actually talk about this, or at least I mentioned at the top that ASEAN, the summit, so we're in APEC now, which is now over here in Bali. It's nighttime in Bali, 12 hours ahead of you. And tomorrow we're going with Kerry to the ASEAN summit, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And there, this whole notion of the maritime disputes between China and many of its neighbors, and, you know, Japan as well with South Korea, this will be front and center at the ASEAN summit tomorrow. And it's certain that China is going to make its views heard. Now, I was with Kerry a few days ago when he and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel were, updating the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance, which Susan Shirk referred to. And it was very interesting because Kerry made a point of reiterating a point that has been made many times before, including by his predecessor, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that the U.S. recognizes the, as Susan said, that the Japanese administer these disputed islands that are called the Senkakus in Japan and are called the Diaoyu Islands in China. And again, under our treaty, our U.S.-Japan alliance, we have treaty obligations to defend Japan. As far as whether we would get pulled into any conflict, I think the United States is trying to make sure that it doesn't get to that point, that there won't be a military conflict. There certainly have been little skirmishes here and there and constant daily, incursions by Chinese boats and Japanese boats and arguments about it. There's no question. But what the U.S. is trying to do is promote that there would be rules of the road and, as Susan referred to, a code of conduct. That's mm-hmm. their term for rules of the road for managing this so that it doesn't turn into a military conflict.
Susan Shirk, in our last minute here, wrap us up and help us understand the long-term impact or implication of President Obama's absence at the APEC summit and the potential for the damage to the relationship with our partners in the region.
You know, there's a problem that the United States has over many decades, many administrations, and a shorthand for it is the tyranny of distance. It is really far from Washington to Asian capitals. It's always hard for us to get our senior officials out to the region, whereas the Asian leaders are jumping back and forth among one another's capitals for one-day meetings all the time. So there's always this worry in Asia about will the U.S. be there when push comes to shove, and finding ways to reassure them is just a constant challenge for the United States.
Susan Shirk, chair of the University of California, San Diego's 21st Century China Program. I really appreciate your time, Susan. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Indira Lakshmanan, covering foreign policy for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much, Indira.
Thank you. Nice to join you.
You can join the conversation online. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.